Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. It's Michael Shelley here. We're brought together once again. Sad news. Former guest of the program, Sandy Nelson, has passed away. He was age 83, and he died on Valentine's Day. Really an incredible drummer. Had so many top 40 instrumental hits, released tons and tons of albums, because after he had his big hits, he just would sort of record the hits of the day and put out one or two albums a year for years and years. Real interesting. He went to the same high school as Jan and Dean and Kim Fowley and Bruce Johnson of the Beach Boys. You may remember when my guest Joel Selvin was on a couple months ago talking about his book Hollywood Eden, that sort of traced the path of all these guys who went to high school together. Super, super interesting. That's over at WFMU.org/Michael if you want a little bit of the Sandy Nelson and that high school background. It's certainly real interesting. So anyway, this is an interview from February 2009. We sort of trace his career, his ups and downs, his demons. I seem to remember he was pretty open about all of this. You know, he did play on the Teddy Bears to Know Him Is to Love Him and the Hollywood Argyle's Alley Oop and a few other sessions around Hollywood before he had his big hit Teen Beat, which really, I think we hear that at the end of the show. It was just a huge, huge hit. And then Let There Be Drums, which we hear at the end of the show, went to number 7. I think Teen Beat went to number 4. So he was just, he had a few other top 10 hits, and it's a very interesting story. So sorry to see him go. Interesting character. This is my chat with the late, great Sandy Nelson. Let There Be Drums, I believe it was a number 7 hit in the United States of America. Joining us on the telephone, Sandy Nelson, welcome to the program. How are you?
Oh, just pretty good. Having nice weather in the desert for right now.
We got snow all over the ground here.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
You're not missing much. That record still sounds fantastic. Was it a surprise when it became a giant hit for you?
Yes, it was. It came at a good time because I had been touring, filling in for the regular drummer for the Ventures, and we were in a lot of snow with their station wagon, and I thought if I could just have one more hit and wouldn't have to go out on the road like this so much, maybe, or something.
Yeah, I just read a book about the Ventures, and we had Don Wilson as a guest a couple weeks ago, and the part of the book that they sort of laugh at when you came on the road with them, you just hated it. It was just no fun for you.
Yeah, their trailer started to disintegrate because of the salt on the highways, and we played small towns, and through Montana and Nebraska.
It's just a lot easier to stay in L.A. and cut hit records, I guess.
Well, that's what I wanted to do, but of course, owner of the company of Imperial said, you got to get out and work. Can't just sit around waiting for record royalties.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. You're born, I believe, 1938, Santa Monica, California. Went to high school with Jan and Dean, Kim Fowley, a lot of folks who were in the music business were in your high school at that time. What was growing up like, and what kind of music were you listening to as a little kid? Were you listening to drummers?
Actually, I listened to Gene Krupa, and I saw him when I was 7 years old, maybe 8. At the Orpheum Theater in downtown L.A. And I saw the shadow of his sticks on the curtain with the, you know, the spotlight. And everybody was standing in the aisles yelling, and I couldn't see him very well. I was, why don't they sit down and shut up so I can hear him? But my other influence, believe it or not, was Spike Jonze. Because the brass, it was so articulate, you know, along with the sound effects. And also, somehow, when I was about nine. I latched on to some of the big bands, like Duke Ellington and so forth, that had tunes that were kind of minor key.
Hmm.
You know, like Song of India. And I think that stuck with me in my head because I thought of the riff for Let There Be Drums. I had Richie Podler play that riff, and it's sort of a minor key, Arabic or Moorish or Spanish or whatever.
Well, it's interesting because your drumming, definitely you hear some jazziness and you hear some old school, you know, you're not a rock drummer, and then you brought that sort of to the rock and roll format, and that's why it's, you know, it sounds so good.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's a lot of variation. It's not just hard hitting for a half hour, you know?
Yeah, the swing era was in me, and then I found myself as a rock and roll drummer in 1958, of course, with Kip Tyler's band.
Kip Tyler and the Flips, and I think Bruce Johnson, later of the Beach Boys, was in that band with you. Is that right?
Yeah, he got us the job, actually. He was always networking out, trying to get us work. He was a hard worker like that. But he gave me the number of, he said that Kip Tyler was going to call me, so stay by the phone. And I was so thrilled because Kip's name was advertised on Art LeBeau rock and roll shows.
Right, he'd been a rock singer for a while. Well, I mean, when's the first time somebody put drums in your hands? How old were you?
Oh, I had a drum set for Christmas. I think it would be 1947. I was 8 years old. And it was an old-fashioned drum set, Mike. It was from the 20s. And this was in 1947, and I thought it was an old drum set. I was kind of had mixed emotions. It even had coconuts on the top of the bass drum.
Wow.
And the painting of a big ship, S-H-I-P, as in Popeye, on the front of the bass drum with a light bulb inside. And I didn't quite know what to do. So the first thing I played was, I just walked up. My aunt was there, and mother and father, and I played right, right, left, right, right, left, right, right, left. And they thought that was great. What they didn't know is that I was spontaneously or inspirationally playing what Buddy Rich played. He played... drummers know what I'm talking about. I don't know if I should say this, but it's just right, right, left, right, right, left, right, right, left. But 60 years later, recently, I found that Buddy Rich played the bass drum every other beat with the right, right, left. Bingo! Took 60 years to figure out what he was doing.
How interesting. So when was the first time you heard rock and roll music? I mean, you're born at a time just at that crossroads. You know, I imagine sometime in the 50s you were, you know, a teenager and heard Elvis or heard Bill Haley or what was it?
Well, I listened to Little Richard and Fats Domino, and I wanted to know who that drummer was. He had a real kind of a fun way of playing. Bass drum was kicking, you bump, 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 boom. And so finally I met the drummer, Earl Palmer. He had been, he started out playing on Little Richard and Fats Domino records in a small recording studio in the back of an appliance store in New Orleans, Cosmo and Sons Appliances. And it was such, he was playing the bass drum along with that nice backbeat.
Yeah, he's one of the most amazing drummers just that ever was. I think he started doing some tap dancing, I think, in whorehouses, and sort of, I think that tap dancing sort of...
That's exactly right. I'm glad you brought that up. His dancing, he was really dancing on the drums.
Yeah.
And when I finally watched him play on records, when you see the companies... recording companies in Hollywood wanted him out there. They said, if you come out here, we'll keep you in work. And indeed they did. Not only that, he got to play out a lot of motion picture tracks. But when I stood there and watched him play, his right hand kind of danced on the drums, on the snare drum, and his left hand, of course, a nice little backbeat. A good example of that was Come On, Let's Go with Ritchie Valens. I watched him record all those things, and I try to emulate him.
So were you just hanging around the studio and watching that stuff? How did you get in there?
The job with Kip Tyler, along with me, with Bruce Johnson and sax player Dave Shostak, S.H. Shostak. We backed up so many acts that we got started. I started playing on some of their records, their demos, and small sessions, you know, like $10-$15 a pop. And that's what got me in the studios, actually.
I know that you played on the Phil Spector To Know Him Is To Love Him track. That's the Teddy Bears 1950. And that's an overdub, is that right?
1958. And yeah, it's just an overdub. What it was Phil had already had a drummer, I don't know who played, might have been Marshall Lieb, played brushes in three time, you know, like waltz time,
right?
But he wanted a backbeat, so I just brought in my snare drum and hi hat for $20 to add a backbeat. And as we went in the studio, Phil was grumbling and bitching about the drummer that he had on the track already couldn't play a backbeat along with the three time, you know, like one, two, three, block, two, three, one, two, three, block. So later on, Marshall Lieb was angry because he wasn't on that side of the record. And he blamed me for being the drummer that couldn't play the three time. But all I did was add the backbeat.
You talk about the lots and lots of demo sessions. Who were you making demos for? What acts? What producers?
Let me see. Oh, there's so many I can't remember. Marvin and Johnny, Sunny Night, the Jaguars, what's the group that?
These would all pay 10 or 15 or 20 bucks?
Oh, yeah. I was also on all the early Vibrations records.
And what about your folks? Were they, like, trying to get you to get a real job, or...
My mother never really saw much money come in when I, you know, was schlepping around like that. Then I decided to make my own record. I made a demo of Teen Beat. I got the idea for the beats from one of which was a strip drummer at a strip place downtown L.A. that Bruce and I and Dave and Jan and Dean and Arnie used to go watch. But I watched the drummer in the pit instead of the girls.
Sure you did, Sandy.
Yeah. I made a little demo of those beats and took it to Art LeBeau, and he liked the title, liked the idea. What was I going to say? Go ahead.
Yeah, that ended up going to number four on the charts, 1959. I mean, that's a giant hit on the Original Sound Records. How'd you meet Art LeBeau? What kind of a guy was he?
I wanted to be a radio disc jockey, not too much a drummer, when I was about 16. And I used to ride my bike up to the small stations in Hollywood, and there was a little station in it that was in a two-story old house in Hollywood, and that's where I met Art, and he was doing a little show. He was only probably about 27 years old or so, and I was 16. And he was nice to me. He told me about radio broadcasting and things. So, bam, a few years later, I joined Kip Tyler and Bruce and I and Dave. Kip drove us down to Art LeBeau's live show at a food drive-in where he'd stick the microphone in kids' cars and have them on the air. He was very smart. And so on the way down, Kip said, "All right, buddies, I'm going to have you meet Art LeBeau." And I was hoping that he would remember me from when I visited him in the little station. And he did. It was really cute. And so Kip thought, "Oh my God, Sammy knows him already." My name was Sam in those days.
And so so you gave him the demo for Teen Beat, and the rest is sort of history. Let's talk about who's on the record of Teen Beat. Who exactly plays on that?
Yeah, that's confusing. Art wanted to hire Barney Kessel, who was a great jazz player. And Barney was on Art's hit of Bongo Rock a year earlier. Hmm. So, but I wanted to start a musical community with Bruce Johnston and Richie Podler. So I insisted on using Richie Podler and Richie's studio, but Richie was playing so many notes. Art coaxed a riff out of him. So Art got songwriters. And Richie's studio, the tape recorder was out of line, a lot of hiss. So Art had to try to rescue Teen Beat at another studio down the street a couple of weeks later. And to rescue the sound, he overdubbed Connie Smith, electric bass player for Eddie Cochran. And it was a genius of an idea. I have to give Art credit. You know, the dong, dong, dong.
Yeah.
And at the same time, Art overdubbed Barney Kessel, strengthening the guitar part. Plus, Barney added chicka chick chicka chick chicka chick chicka. And I would have never thought of that. That was Art's idea.
And is Bruce Johnson on that record too?
Yeah. He was on the track we made at Richie's studio. Richie, Bruce, and myself. And Bruce, Bruce was a character. He was imaginative. Not only he actually should have gotten part songwriters on it, because it was his idea to have the modulations five steps, like bum, 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 instead of just two steps.
Huh.
But Bruce took his shoes off and put it in the piano to add a chunk-a-chunk-a-chunk sound.
Wow.
So you're hearing the piano on the guitar riff, you know, with his shoes in the piano.
I never heard that. Let me remind the folks we're listening to. Sandy Nelson here has been kind enough to join us and talk about some of his giant hit records that he made. So you get signed to Art LeBeau's original sound label, and did he sell your contract to Imperial? Is that what happened?
Well, actually, Art, I assumed that it was going to be a band, you know, like call us the Foontones or something.
Right.
I thought Richie...
Richie, who went on to produce Joy to the World by Three Dog Night and Born to Be Wild by Steppenwolf and some big records. Yeah. So you thought it would be a band, but he signed you as a solo act, I guess.
In other words, I assumed it would be a band.
Right.
But when Art, he shocked me. He called me up and he said, "There's going to be your name on it." I said, "What about the other guys?" He says, "Never mind them. This is your baby." And I thought, oh, I'm going to get hell for this, which I did. But this is kind of personal or whatever. But he didn't want to deal with their mothers. And I don't blame him, because his mothers can really, like stage door mother type thing. Like, I want my son to have a higher percentage. All right. And so the truth is, Art said, there's not going to be any artist contract for you, Sandy. I'm just going to give you a songwriter's contract. He said, it costs a lot of money to promote a record, but if this makes any noise, you're going to be in good shape. I'll take care of you, which he would have. And so the record came out, I only had the songwriter's contract, and it was a hit. And of course, everybody said you ought to sue Art for artist royalties, there never would have been a Teen Beat if Richie and Bruce were on the contract with their mothers, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There never would have been a Teen Beat.
So did he take care of you? Did he give you your fair share, do you think?
He didn't have a chance. Kip Tyler all of a sudden became my manager. Like Art used to say, you used to be his drummer, now he's your singer. But Art, Kip took me to different record companies since I was unsigned. And I landed, at the end of the day, we went to Imperial Records, which was in an old building on Hollywood Boulevard. And I had to take a leak. So I signed the contract in a hurry. And the owner, Lou Chud, looked kind of like Larry King. He had a big desk. He said, aren't you going to read it? And I said, I don't know what it's all about. What I didn't know, Mike, was that Lou happened to be one of the very honest record companies in the land.
Oh, lucky for you.
He actually paid royalties. My goodness, what a concept. That's why I was so happy to have Let There Be Drums a hit, because that time I got some real money. And Lou didn't trust me with my money, so he said, bring your mother down. I want her to be my manager. And my mother was thinking, what's all this about? Because she's never seen any big money in the business. And then when Lou read off what he owed me, my mother started to faint.
How much was it back in those days?
Well, that was that first little amount. It doesn't seem like anything now. It was only $13,000. But it started to climb up the charts.
Well, $13,000 in 1961 is a fortune. It's a fortune now.
I bought a brand new Chevy station wagon the same day.
How much was that?
Oh, I don't know. I have no idea. But soon after which, I was making about $1,000 a week deferred royalties. And then I'll go ahead.
Well, did it go to your head, this sort of sudden burst of money?
It was a shock, you know.
Did you start living a crazy lifestyle?
Oh, I got engaged to a girl. We went to steakhouses in Hollywood, and I didn't party a lot. I bought a small motorcycle. And I was engaged to this girl. She lived in San Diego with her parents, actually. Originally, her parents brought her and her sister up to get her in show business. So they didn't really get into show business particularly. Go ahead. Ask me.
So you put out Teen Beat. You get signed to Imperial, which gets bought by Liberty Records, and you put out Let There Be Drums, which goes to number 7 on the top 100. 1961.
Actually, went to number 4 Chicago or Detroit, one of the two, Detroit or Chicago. I think Chicago went to number 4. But go ahead.
Then you start putting out records, and in the next few years, I think it's something like 18 records in 4 years. And just the sheer number of records you put out is astonishing. And I'm wondering, you know, how quickly were those records made? A lot of them are just cover songs of the day, but a lot of them
Some
of them are just fantastic versions. I don't know. I guess you weren't listening, but just before you came on, we heard Get On Up, Casbah, Buckaroo Boogaloo, Good Lovin', Come On, Let's Go, and Let There Be Drums.
Oh, yeah.
And every one of those songs, to me, just a great, you know, 2 minutes and 17 seconds of explosion. You know, from the second those records start, there's no...
Yeah, Casbah is a real sleeper. That Richie, I have to give credit to Richie. He put that together and wrote it.
I mean, yeah, who was writing the songs, who was doing the arranging, and who's playing on those records? Who are the session guys on some of those records? I mean, is it Glenn Campbell on there? Are those guys on there?
Oh, yeah, Glenn Campbell, Billy Strange, Barney Kessel, James, it's too early. you know, the guitar player that...
James Burton?
Yeah, James Burton.
And would you guys, would it be just, go ahead.
Lyle Ritz.
Sure.
Carol Kay, eventually in the middle 60s. See, I was assigned to do all these tunes I didn't want to do. And I was drinking heavy then because I'd lost my leg in that motorcycle accident.
Right, 1963, got in a motorcycle accident, lost your whole right foot and part of your leg, right?
The right foot.
And that's your kick drum foot, right?
Yeah, I switched to the left foot. I thought it was going to take a long time to get used to it, but it didn't take as long as I thought. But in the long run, I play the bass drum better because I do more of a, a rebound type technique.
So you're drinking a lot, and you're being forced to record these songs you don't want. Who was picking the songs?
The company. You see, when I lost my leg in 1963, Lou Chudd, Chudd, owner of Imperial, used to drink a lot. He used to always find excuses to go down to a bar in the building. When he had lost Ricky Nelson because he had a quarrel with Ozzy, the father, over something to do with tax, paying money to, I don't know, that's not important, but he lost Ricky and lost Fats Domino, and I lost my leg. So Lou, the secretary, told me later, he says, I'm going to sell the whole goddamn thing. So he sold the whole thing, publishing interest, masters, all to Liberty Records.
Mm.
So when I got out of the hospital and started recording again, I had to answer to all these blow-dried A&R men, and they assigned me to do all these tunes that I didn't really want to do. But I only look for the bad. There was a lot of good ones, like you say. There was a lot of fun things.
Yeah, so tell me, was it just... your typical three-hour session, you'd cut three songs, you know, so cut an album in four sessions, or how did it work?
No, you got me confused. No, some of them were just dates, you know, in the studio. I'd play with the studio men. The one opportunity there, Barney Kessel was on, and Ray Brown. They were from the Pole Winners 3, and Ray Brown was in the coffee room, and Barney and I were playing some jazz on the break, and I thought, I wish Ray would come in and pick up the bass. All these tracks that I were assigned to do, but I do a lot, some of the tracks on my home studio, just, you know, kind of take my time and add sound effects, like All Around the World and drums. I did that at my little home studio. Hmm. And then one in the 60s, when I lived in out in Brentwood, I did a thing called Freak Beat, which I did played the guitar on. I overdubbed guitar quite a lot on the stuff I did at home.
And then that stuff would be mixed back in the studio,
Yeah, add echo.
Yeah. So let me remind folks, this is WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, and WFMU.org, and Sandy Nelson is my guest today. It's really quite an amazing career. Tell me what happened sort of as the 70s started to approach and the whole music business changed and the whole music scene changed. What did you do?
I played in restaurants in Santa Monica and got to know a guy named Dick Leslie. In fact, we made a thing called Dick's Boogie, number 5, in a small studio in the early 80s when I stopped drinking. But my enjoyment was playing live in a small, you know, restaurants in Santa Monica.
Sandy, can I ask you, how'd you stop drinking?
Well, it got to a point, you know, as you always hear, where drinking doesn't really work for you anymore, and I come to a thing. Well, gee, I can't be sober, I can't stop drinking, couldn't visualize that, and yet I couldn't stay drunk. That wasn't working. Ending up in nut houses and hospitals and rehabs and everything. So I finally came to terms. It was sort of a quiet spiritual experience. I just had my last drink in 1976. And, well, we don't have to go into all that.
No. Well, good for you. I'm glad you got it together. You live now just outside Vegas, Boulder City, Nevada. Is that right?
Yeah.
What brought you out there?
Oh, I always had a hankering to live in the desert. I used to just travel around just at random all over the, you know, places like Bakersfield or parts of the desert out here.
And what's your life like? What are your days like now? I know you just completed last year a new record with the Sin City Termites called Nelsonized, and there's a MySpace webpage for that, and I've got a link to that on the playlist.
Uh-huh.
So you're still playing, and you still sound great.
Oh, yeah. Well, I love piano. I've always played piano. The joke is in band room back when I was about 16 at Uni High, I was in the band. Of course, there was like 6 other drummers, too. There's always a lot of drummers. We'd jam at the lunch hour, and I'd play a little piano, a little block chords on the piano with the bass player. And they said, well, can you go to E-flat or B-flat? So I said, nuts to this. I couldn't find B-flat, so I stayed with drums. But eventually, I wanted to, you know, I'm studying piano on my own. Hmm. I play at the Boulder Dam Hotel in the lobby once in a while.
You play the piano?
Yeah, they have a grand piano there.
How fun. We talked about Earl Palmer a bit and, you know, one of the greatest drummers. Any other, what about, you cross paths with Hal Blaine ever?
Yeah, well, Hal, I was kind of like Phil Spector's drummer. Phil would have me go in and try out little studios, try out their echo chambers. But I didn't have the interest in multiple tom-toms like Hal did. Mm. He was very aggressive and very articulate with multiple tom-tom fills. And by then I was starting to go on the road a little bit and making royalties. I didn't care about doing sessions for people. So Hal did the you know, the Phil Spector stuff. But like I say, he did a very good job of tuning the drums and muffling them and working where I really didn't care.
Hmm. That's interesting. So your days now, you play some music, you're enjoying the desert. Is there anything next for you? Is there something coming up?
Oh, I'd like to get a nice vehicle to be able to travel like I used to and just kind of goof off. I lived in a motorhome for a few years a while back. I really enjoyed that. I really loved it.
So you just want to goof off. That sounds like...
I played I mean, I had a recording studio in the motorhome, and I made a track called The Veeble. It took me 2 years to mix it down and overdub in the motorhome.
Yeah, I'll bet.
But I can't seem to do much with it. My friend in Montana, Ramey, he doesn't want to have much to do with it. But maybe we'll send you one. It's called The Veeble Song.
I'd love to hear it.
The Veebles are coming to make all earthlings laugh and dance.
Oh, you got to send
me. Tell dumb jokes. As you can see, I can't understand why no one wants to join.
Sounds like a hit record. Well, I'm going to close this out by playing Teen Beat. We've pretty much discussed the song pretty in-depthly, but is there anything else the folks need to know about it?
Yeah, I want to say Art LeBeau not having the artist contract, just the songwriters, but like you said, he was going to take care of me, but it happened much bigger than that, because to this day, I'm 70 years old, I'm making a living on royalties and BMI and everything, it started with Art, see?
Hmm.
It's really, really kind of a sweet story. Yeah. And then the money he made from Teen Beat got him in the Oldies But Goodies business, he told me.
Hmm.
He thought of that name. That's his name, Oldies But Goodies.
Right, that series. It's been great for both of you, and this record is just about almost 50 years old, which is hard to believe.
Yeah.
Well, it's been great to talk to you, Sandy. This has really been fun.
Yeah, I love radio broadcasting still.
Well, if you're ever in New York, come on down and we'll do a show together.
Oh, I still love to visit radio stations.
All right. Sandy Nelson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike.
Sure.
Thank you, Mike.
Peace.